Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
It's Here and Now. In a moment, how children of the privileged are being recruited by major colleges. But first, authorities in North Carolina are still letting a huge fire at a hazardous waste facility in the Raleigh suburb of Apex burn itself out rather than risk a chemical reaction from water or foam. More than 24 people have been treated at area hospitals for respiratory complaints after the fire caused a toxic cloud of dangerous gas to form and spread a few miles beyond the facility. Keith Weatherly is the mayor of Apex.
We did have a sighting of it as far from the site as Highway 55 and 64 intersection, which is a major commercial site.
As many as 17,000 people were asked to evacuate their homes, in effect told to run from the cloud, and several hundred spent the night in shelters set up by emergency officials in area schools. Lauren Madelon is a reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. Lauren, how has this affected your area?
It's caused a lot of chaos. Right now, the town looks like a ghost town. There's nobody in the street. There's no vehicles in the street. The school system, except for two schools on the outskirts of Apex, has shut down completely. And there's a big area, a triangle, bounded by three major arteries that you cannot get in or get out of. If you didn't decide to take the request to leave your home, you've now been told that you must stay there, pending the outcome of this incident, because right now, the authorities have an idea of what they're dealing with, but not a complete idea, not to the point that they're ready to let those who left come back in and let those who are in get out.
We understand they're being pretty firm about that. One official saying, if people choose to come, go ahead and write their names on their foreheads along with the names of their next of kin.
That was advice, very strong advice, given by the town manager of Apex, Bruce Radford. He was the one who first came out and said what the company would not at this point confirm, and that is that we're dealing with some sort of a chlorine spill. And as a consequence, he was issuing that advice not to come because the town managers are simply not willing to risk harm to life and limb by those who are drawn like moss to a flame to such a severe scene.
Well, the facility where the fire started is run by a Michigan-based company called Environmental Quality. What kind of waste does it handle? Is it just chlorine? And does anyone know how the fire started?
It handles chlorine, paint solvents, and a number of as yet unidentified hazardous wastes, as well as non-hazardous waste. Sometime around 10 p.m. Eastern last night, a fire was noticed after a very acrid odor was noticed in the air. A huge blaze started. Flames were seen leaping 200 feet into the air. And that is what we know. Now, on the heels of this incident, the company has been asked today who was there. They said, well, none of our employees were there. The last shift checked out at 7 p.m. The subsequent question is a logical one. Were there security staff on the scene? The company refuses to comment on that. And the unanswered question is do they have the legal obligation to have people there 24 hours a day? There seems to be some legal lack of clarity at this point. What I can tell you about this company, though, is that there might be a reason for its lack of being forthcoming at this point, and that is that just last March, here in North Carolina, they faced six citations from state environmental authorities. The bottom line, the common denominator to all these citations, Robin, is that they had failed to adequately measure up to state-mandated safety standards, both in the operation of the plant and in terms of a contingency plan that it was required to draw up in the event of just such an event as we are now experiencing down here. In addition, if you go back some 12 years, in Michigan, the company entered into a voluntary consent judgment for $500,000 after a fire at a waste treatment plant, and it has had actually, in fact, at several locations across the country, run-ins with environmental authorities in several states, and its lack of clarity in terms of what is actually stored there has upset a lot of citizens here today.
Lauren Madelon, he's a reporter for North Carolina Public Radio. He's been covering this fire at the hazardous waste facility in Apex, North Carolina. Lauren, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Nice to talk to you, Robin.
Well, it's the time of year to turn attention to colleges, with many parents and kids trying to choose one. It probably comes as no surprise to them that children of the rich and famous have an easier time getting into schools. But what may not be as well known is how much the rich are actively recruited based on their wealth rather than academic achievement. Some schools court children of celebrities to boost the university's PR value. Then there's the practice called considering context, in which a college admits every applicant from a specific high school, so no one notices that an underqualified but privileged student from that same school is also accepted. Pulitzer Prize-winning Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Golden lays this system bare in his new book, The Price of Admission. He joins us in the studio to take us through it. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You write that some colleges actually completely change their identities through this practice.
That's right. I examined both Duke and Brown University, and Duke made a strategic decision under Terry Sanford in the 1970s to go out and recruit more students from private schools with affluent backgrounds so that it could boost its endowment and move up in the ranks of higher education. And it worked as a strategy. I mean, it was part of the reason why Duke has gotten into the top 10. But, of course, it comes as a price. They compromised their admissions process and took students of lesser caliber over top applicants.
Well, these kids who come from these privileged families are apparently called, there's a name for them, development cases.
Yeah, college admissions is full of euphemisms. And a development case is what they term somebody who's recommended by the fundraising office or development office, who's put on a list and flagged for special priority in admissions. And generally, the pure development case, the parent is not an alumnus. So it's sort of distinguished from legacy preference, which is for children of alumni. The development case has no connection to the university through the family, other than the fact that the parent is considered a likely donor or benefactor if the child is admitted.
Do they sort of scan the horizon and say, famous person's 15-year-old is going to be getting older soon? I mean, do they start taking notes on children, or is it that the kids apply?
The wealthy family may hire an independent counselor who makes kind of a back-channel inquiry to the fundraising office. So-and-so's son or daughter is thinking of applying. The family's prepared to be generous. What do you think the prospects are? And so there's a lot of discreet inquiries behind the scenes that go on.
Mm. Well, we mentioned in the introduction the lengths that some schools will go to, including something apparently known in the trade as considering context. What's
yes, considering context is when a student who's a development case or a prominent legacy applies and they're, say, in the middle of their high school class. And let's imagine that maybe some other students applied who were much better students. The college then may not want to accept the development case while turning down the better students for fear that there'll be an angry reaction from those students and their families. So what the college may do in that situation is admit all of those students. This happened a few years ago when Bill Frist's oldest son, Harrison, applied to Princeton from St. Albans School. He was one of five applicants from St. Albans and the lowest academically. In fact, the admissions office at Princeton gave him their lowest ranking. He was admitted by Princeton because his father was an alumnus, a former trustee. The Frist family had given Princeton $25 million. And lo and behold, the other four applicants with better records at St. Albans were also all admitted to Princeton.
What does this do to other applicants?
Well, you have to remember that for every student they take, they turn down eight or nine others, these elite schools. They only take one in 10 or one in nine. So the result is there's fewer spaces for students from other schools.
Well, you also write about Brown University. Another approach, not just appealing to children whose families might have money to then contribute to the school, but might have a name, a celebrity name. And it does feel as if Brown University seems to have a lot of young people who are famous.
Oh, Brown has a large number of children of celebrities, whether they're Dustin Hoffman's children, Kevin Costner's, Danny DeVito's, a child of John Kerry's, Mike Dukakis. It all goes back to JFK Jr., the most famous student possibly ever at Brown. And that brought Brown so much visibility that it seems to have realized that this happenstance could become a strategy to put it on the map.
So you're not implying that Brown, lured him in because he was a celebrity?
No, I think he liked Brown. That happenstance, I think, then at some point turned into a realization that this was a route to visibility and prominence.
Well, give us more of your, proof of that. Make your case of that.
Well, the best example of that is the son of Michael Ovitz, the Hollywood power broker and agent. He was not a top student in his prep school, not in the cum laude society, not taking advanced classes. And the Brown admissions office felt that he was too much of a stretch, and they didn't want to take him. But the Brown president at the time, Gordon Gee, he insisted because he wanted access not just to Mr. Ovitz's wealth, but also to the parade of important Hollywood clients that he had.
Well, the former president of Brown, Vartan Gregorian, as you well know, recently wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal criticizing some of these conclusions you make. He says Brown has the highest caliber of student and also says, you know, and besides, I don't think that because children are children of the rich or the famous, that they're necessarily mediocre and shouldn't get into Brown.
Certainly many children of the rich and powerful are very fine students, and I think they should be judged on the same merit basis as everybody else. And if they have that merit, I think it's fine for them to be admitted. Mr. Gregorian had been president of the New York Public Library. And while he was there, he made friends with Gordon Getty and Mrs. Getty, the heirs of the famous oil baron J. Paul Getty. And they gave the New York Public Library $1 million. So then shortly after that, he became president of Brown, which had the lowest endowment in the Ivy League, and his mission was as a well-known and proven fundraiser to raise that endowment. So he talked to the Gettys, who had a son soon to go to college named William, who was not a top student, and he advised the Gettys to send William to Brown, and then he encouraged the Brown admissions office to admit him. So William came, and then he dropped out of Brown in less than a year, and the Gettys did not donate significantly to Brown. I think it's not an unreasonable conclusion to draw that he at least had in the back of his mind that the Gettys might donate if their son came and was successful.
Well, and some would say, what's wrong with that? You know, for instance, Daniel Saraceno, who's an assistant provost for enrollment at the University of Notre Dame, wrote in the Chicago Tribune recently that every student they admit must be capable, but that taking into the account the financial capability of a student helps them give a free ride to students who can't afford it.
Well, there's two problems with that argument. The first is that there's a lack of transparency about it on the part of colleges. I mean, you rarely hear a college say to parents, we encourage your child to admit, but we have to let you know that they'll be at a disadvantage compared to children of the rich who can donate a lot of money. Mm-hmm. You know, colleges rarely include that in their pitch. They pose as meritocratic, even though they aren't. The other problem with it is that while I think it's very important to raise money for scholarships and faculty salaries and laboratories and so on, I don't think you necessarily have to compromise admissions to do that. In my book, I give a number of case studies, Caltech, Berea College, Cooper Union in New York, that have raised plenty of money without corrupting their admissions process in any way. They raise money on the basis of an attractive mission, excellent programs, good scholarship, and they prove that there is an alternative model. You know, compromising admissions to raise money is really taking the easy way out.
That's Wall Street Journal reporter Dan Golden. His new book is The Price of Admission. When we come back, how, Dan says, Asian Americans in particular suffer from this practice of picking the privileged kids first, and also how colleges use sports for the well-to-do, squash, golf, horseback riding, to accept unqualified but privileged students and you know, fill up their coffers at the same time. He'll make that case when we come back. Much more ahead here and now. Robin Young, it's here and now. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Dan Golden of The Wall Street Journal. His new book is called The Price of Admission. He investigated the admissions policies of many elite universities, and he says many aggressively favor the rich and well-connected with staff members whose job that is. And Dan, you also look at how admissions policies seem to discriminate against, in particular, Asian American students. How so?
Well, Asian American students are held to a higher standard than any other group, including whites. If you look at the average entering SAT score for Asian students at the elite schools, it's higher than it is for white students. And they seem to be in a position analogous to Jews in the era of the quotas, where There's more Asian students at these colleges than their proportion in the population, but fewer than you'd expect given their academic qualifications. And it's quite sad. I interviewed one young Asian woman. She told me she had an SAT score of something in the 1500s out of 1600. This was before they went to the new scoring system. And I said, congratulations, that's wonderful. And she said, oh, no, we call that an Asian fail, because if you're Asian, you need 1600, and the elite schools won't accept anything else.
This is interesting to hear, because there is a perception that the large number of Asian students that you see on college campuses is because these are foreign students whose parents are, you know, wealthy, suddenly wealthy Chinese parents, for instance, are paying the full boat. You're saying no.
Yeah, these are not foreign students coming in through that route paying full tuition. These are Asian American students at the U.S. colleges who often come from working class or middle class backgrounds and often need financial aid. We're not talking about the wealthy and privileged here for the most part.
You also write that elite universities also use their sports programs to admit wealthier kids with less than stellar academics. Now, this is nothing new, that sports programs admit kids who don't have the right academics, but this is sort of, this is a new branch of that. How does this affect rich kids?
Well, I think most people watch college sports on television, college basketball or football, at least I do, and they think that college sports are diverse racially and economically because they see a lot of faces of different races and backgrounds. But the fact is that there's many, many college sports that you rarely see on TV. Crew, horseback riding, squash, fencing, sailing, and so on, that are overwhelmingly white and affluent and are only played in prep schools. In my book, I compare the sports played at public high schools in Boston, like East Boston High, with those offered at Andover and Exeter. And Andover and Exeter offer many, many more of these blue blood sports, and as a result, their students have an advantage. If they're skilled in those sports, they get an admissions break, and at some schools, even a scholarship. And so I point to this as kind of evidence of socioeconomic unfairness in athletic preference, because many kids never have a chance to play the sports that earn a preference.
Whereas kids in those prep schools also have a chance to play basketball and football and the traditional scholarship sports.
That's absolutely right. And one other point I'd just like to make, which I think is new in my chapter, is that Title IX, the gender equity law, has actually contributed to a lack of socioeconomic diversity in athletics, because what's happened is in the last few years, the women's sports that colleges have introduced to offset the football team are overwhelmingly women's crew and women's equestrian events, which, of course, are not working class sports. At the same time, they've cut men's sports like wrestling and track and field, which involve a lower socioeconomic class. So Title IX is aiding gender equity, but it's hurting socioeconomic diversity.
According to what you found out, when they bring these high-level sports in, they're bringing money in. It's all about bringing money into the school. People might want to underwrite a new horseback riding facility if their child goes to that school.
That's right. And, you know, many people were surprised earlier this year during the whole Duke rape scandal, where the Duke lacrosse players were accused of raping a woman from another college. The statistic came out during that 46 of the 47 men on the Duke lacrosse team are white, and the three indicted had all gone to expensive private high schools. But this is no exception in the lower profile sports. It's the norm.
We want to touch on one last subject. You also write that some universities have a policy of accepting students of faculty members even when those students aren't qualified. Now, we have to rush to say, in full disclosure, Boston University here in Boston owns the license that our home station, WBUR, operates from. And employees here at the station can take advantage of tuition reimbursement programs. For some of those employees, that's what sort of supplements, in many cases, their lower salaries that they might get somewhere else. So they may not be as critical as you might be of this. To them, that's sort of making up for what the institution is not paying them.
Well, I think it is a fair benefit in one sense, that I think it makes sense for faculty if their salary is not that sufficient to supplement it with tuition benefit. But here's the problem. Since, you know, as you know, the admissions office often has less clout than the faculty members who have tenure, the admissions office, knowing which side their bread is buttered, they tend to admit all the faculty kids. So at BU, the admission rate for faculty children is much, much higher than it is for all applicants. And while some of them are very strong students, just like some of the wealthy are very strong students, others are not. And so the overall standards are lower. Now, there is a solution to this, which is Many schools have a program where they give the same tuition benefit to the faculty child no matter what college they attend. So if a school provides the same tuition benefit for the faculty child no matter where they attend, then you take away the pressure from the admissions office to admit the child, and you also take away the pressure from the child to stay home, and I think that's a much healthier situation. Mm-hmm. Those are called portable tuition plans, and for that reason, I think they're much better than the non-portable variety where the benefit is only given if the child goes to the parent's institution.
Dan Golden, you went to Harvard. Legacy student?
No, my parents were both immigrants, and my father went to City College of New York, and my mother went to Skidmore on a refugee program, so I'm not a legacy.
Do you think you'd get into Harvard today?
Not unless my parents were capable of giving millions of dollars, which they weren't, so no, I wouldn't.
Really? And I'm assuming you had pretty good grades and...
I was a strong student, but right now, if I applied now with those same credentials, there's no way I would get in. I would be lumped in with the great majority of, you know, very strong middle-class students who really don't have a prayer because they're only taking the absolute top of that group.
Well, we're glad you went. One of the results, the new book, The Price of Admission, An Investigation into University Admission Policies. Dan Golden is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for the Wall Street Journal. Dan, thanks so much for coming to talk to us.
I've enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
And we want to give you this update, a terrific story next week on Here and Now, the story of a 7-foot-tall Chinese eunuch who had a fleet of 400 ships that sailed 30,000 miles before Columbus, only to be lost to history. Also, should boys and girls share the same classroom? The heated debate over single-sex education. That's all next week. Stay with us. More ahead Here and Now. Funding and Young, it's Here and Now. This week in Scottsdale, Arizona, President Bush signed the Homeland Security Bill into law. The president said the bill is an important piece of legislation that will highlight our government's highest responsibility, and that is to protect the American people. The bill also had some measures relating to the Federal Emergency Management Agency. The president said the law will help our government respond to emergencies and natural disasters by strengthening FEMA. Well, one of the provisions of the bill would require that the head of FEMA have at least minimum qualifications. And hours after signing it, according to today's Boston Globe, the president issued what is called a signing statement, which gives him the right to ignore that requirement. Joining us on the line from Washington is Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, who first broke the story last spring about the record number of signing statements used by President Bush to claim executive privilege to ignore the bills he's signed into law. Charlie, remind us first, what is a signing statement?
Thanks for having me.
And remind us first, what is a signing statement?
A signing statement is an official document issued by a president on the day he signs a bill into law. Although it is a public document, it's not intended for public consumption. It's very technical and very legalistic. It's essentially instructions to the executive branch and, in cases where there might be a court case, future courts, of his legal interpretation of the bill, what it means and what it doesn't mean. In the context that we're talking about, signing statements are used by presidents, especially this president, to claim that chunks of bills that he's just signed into law are unconstitutional because they intrude on what he sees as his own powers as president or commander-in-chief, and therefore they need not be obeyed as Congress wrote them.
Now, signing statements are legal? He has the authority to do this?
It's a big question. Signing statements are not mentioned in the Constitution. The underlying issue is, does a president have the power to sort of unilaterally declare that chunks of laws that he signed are unconstitutional when a court hasn't said that they're unconstitutional, mm-hmm. and therefore, you know, nullify them in the eyes of the executive branch, or at least say we'll follow them as a matter of policy when we want to, but we're not bound to obey them as a matter of law when we don't want to.
Well, I suppose a signing statement would only be tested once the president actually acted upon the signing of the statement and had some sort of action that would then be tested if, in fact, people knew that he did it.
Right. Well, this is one of the great problems or thorny issues surrounding this topic, especially with this administration's record-breaking use of signing statements to challenge laws.
How many has he used?
He has challenged more than 800 laws using about 100 signing statements because, of course, some bills have more than one law in them.
Well, let's talk about the provision in the Homeland Security bill related to the head of FEMA that incurred the latest signing statement. First of all, what is the provision, and how did it get, and how and why did it get into the bill?
All right. Well, As everyone remembers, a year ago was Hurricane Katrina along the Gulf Coast, and it was a debacle, especially in New Orleans. FEMA totally botched the rescue and aid effort. And then amid the scrutiny over what had gone wrong, it emerged that Michael Brown, who was the president's choice to lead that agency, was a politically connected appointee. He had no prior emergency management experience. And so Congress had a series of hearings. This is the Republican-led Congress. Had a series of hearings into how to fix FEMA, what had gone wrong. They came up with some legislative proposals that got folded into the big 2007 Homeland Security budget bill. One of the provisions said, from now on, presidents can only nominate people to be director of FEMA if they have 5 years of executive experience and they have a demonstrated commitment and knowledge of emergency management.
Well, what was the president's written explanation for the signing statement bypassing that requirement?
President Bush, in his signing statement, said that this requirement intruded on his what he saw as his constitutional powers to appoint who he pleased to executive branch positions. He says that this purports to limit the qualifications of the pool of persons from whom the president may select the appointee in a manner that rules out a large number of, or a large portion of those persons best qualified by experience and knowledge to fill the office.
Well, but I thought that the provision called for somebody to be qualified.
Yeah, it's a somewhat ludicrous statement.
You report that President Bush also shot down a provision contained in the bill that would have empowered the head of FEMA to report to Congress without White House permission. What was President Bush's explanation for shooting down that?
He said that this purports to limit supervision of an executive branch official and the provision of advice to Congress, which he said violated his powers as president to control the flow of information out of the executive branch to Congress. And so even though Congress had specifically given this independence to this position, he said that that wouldn't count. The FEMA director would still be required to get clearance from the White House before telling lawmakers anything.
What's the, I mean, give us some context for that. I mean, what other top heads of agencies have the right to go right to Congress?
Susan Collins, who's the Republican chairwoman of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate, pointed out to me that the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has statutory independence to tell Congress, you know, what he thinks the nation's national security needs are, our military needs are. And this is simply saying the head of our emergency response should also have that ability.
Well, the public image was of the president signing this Homeland Security bill with great enthusiasm and flourish. When were these signing statements overturning some of the provisions in the bill disclosed?
There's a pattern to this sort of thing. On Wednesday morning in Scottsdale, Arizona, President Bush signed this law. He had a big ceremony. He gave a big speech. I called the White House a couple times on Wednesday and said, is there going to be a signing statement on this bill? And they wouldn't even tell me if there was going to be one. They said, well, if there is one, if it exists, it'll come out the usual way. They finally issued it around 8 p.m. on Wednesday, which meant that everyone had gone home. No one really knew it was there. And all of Thursday's papers and Wednesday's television broadcast, which covered that ceremony, there was no mention of the signing statement. It was an attempt, obviously, just to sort of minimize attention to its content.
Charlie Savage, just one last question. What do you think is going on here? One would think that, especially after all the criticism of Michael Brown, when it was revealed that he had relatively no experience to be the head of FEMA, one would think that one of the provisions that the Bush administration would hold up proudly and say, you know, this is what we're going to do, is one that would have minimum requirements for someone to head FEMA. Why isn't that the case?
Well, you know, we talk about this as if President Bush and the White House are a monolithic force. Of course, that's not the case. Behind the scenes, there are different factions and different players that have influence. This signing statement is clearly not smart politics, especially this time of year. I doubt that Karl Rove was behind this signing statement. This signing statement is part of the Bush administration's legal team, which is dominated by Vice President Cheney's top aide, David Addington, to relentlessly expand the conception of executive power, both for themselves and for future presidents. One of the things that they're interested in doing, clearly, is expanding the sense that Congress cannot set limits on who the president appoints to positions, because the Constitution gives him the power to make appointments. That must mean that he can appoint anyone to do anything. Whenever one of these things pops up, they're going to stomp on it, even if it's something that might remind the public of Hurricane Katrina and Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job, you know, in October of an election year.
Charlie Savage of the Boston Globe, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, coming up, put on your dancing shoes, the Brazilian girls. Make that one girl. Wait, she's not Brazilian. Anyway, they're tuning up. They're next. Much more ahead here and now. Dear Mexican, why do Mexicans call white people gringo? That was the first question answered by Ask a Mexican, a column that's been a fixture of the Orange County Weekly since November 2004. The column offers an often completely politically incorrect running dialogue on what it means to be Mexican-American, including definitions. Here's one for piñata, a toy that Mexicans beat to spill forth goodies stuffed inside, otherwise known as the United States. 27-year-old Gustavo Arellano, who's also an investigative reporter and food editor for The Weekly, writes the column and joins us from Santa Ana, California. Gustavo, what were you thinking when you started this Ask a Mexican?
Well, thank you so much for having me. Basically, I operate here in Orange County, California, which is the Mexican-hating capital of the United States. So I've been on the anti-immigrant beat for a long time, and I figured after doing many investigative reports on it, it was time to have fun with the very contentious issue. So I decided to start fielding questions that people had about Mexicans and answering them in both a thorough and also a hilarious manner.
Now, when you say that it's the anti-Mexican, is that what you say, anti-Mexican capital of the world?
Of the United States, yes.
You also call it the Ellis Island of the U.S.
Across the country, Orange County historically had the image of being like the bastion of white Republican voters. But in fact, Orange County is teeming with immigrants. The city where I work in Santa Ana, it's the most Latino city in the United States with a population of over 100,000 people. We also have the largest Vietnamese community in the world outside of Vietnam. Because of that diversity and because of the previous generations of people who lived in Orange County, you have a lot of ethnic tension here.
Right. Well, but as you well know, so you call this area, anti-Mexican, Mexican-hating. Mm-hmm. Some would wonder if they just glanced at your column on a particular day if you were also self-hating. Because I'm looking, for instance, at some of the debates that you have with some of your readers. Mm-hmm. In one column, you blamed Chicano studies for some of the problems. Chicano, you were laughing because it is a very funny exchange, but also some seriousness. You say Chicano studies, the study of Mexican Americans, corrupts the brains of young Mexicans with antiquated concepts like victimization, objectification, and grade inflation. It creates insufferable self-righteous bores. Have people asked you if you're self-hating?
Of course, that happens all the time. But I'll call things as I see them. If I see there's something wrong, that, you know, racism against Mexicans, I'll call it out. But I also think there's some issues that have to be dealt with in the Mexican and Mexican-American community that a lot of people don't talk about. So something like Chicano studies, which in this week's column, actually, I offer more clarification about it. But also in other issues like, you know, homophobia in the Mexican community or racism against African Americans in the Mexican community. These are issues that some people don't want to talk about and that I try to address in my column.
How did you answer that very first question? Why do Mexicans call white people gringo? Because I read in a later list, you also have definition lists all the time, and you say that gringo isn't even the right word.
Mexicans don't call gringos gringos. Only gringos call gringos gringos. Mexicans, in fact, call gringos gabachos. And that term is actually, and some people also take issue with me for that. They'll say, oh, I mean, of course, you know, Mexicans do call gringos gringos. And what I'm trying to point out is why on earth are Mexicans even calling Americans anything at all? You know, gringos or gabachos, they should be just be calling them Americans. But one of the things I do try to do with the column is also show people who aren't very familiar with Mexican culture is that there's more to it than just what's already known here besides tacos and gringos and amigo.
Do I understand you're a fourth generation Mexican and that was it your father?
Actually, my great-grandfather migrated to Orange County in the early 1900s to pick oranges, but when it was time for him to have a family, he went back to Mexico, had his kids, brought up my grandfather when he was a child. He grew up here. He did the same thing as his father, went down to Mexico, had his kids. My dad, he himself was an illegal immigrant. He came to this country in 1968 in the trunk of a Chevy along with three other guys. They crossed the San Diego-Tijuana border, And so he lived out as a legal immigrant until the Amnesty Act of 86 made him into a legal immigrant. And now he hates illegal immigrants. And, what I always try to tell people, former illegal immigrant, now a citizen, hates illegal immigrants. And if that's not assimilation, I don't know what is.
Gustavo Arellano, he writes the Ask a Mexican column at the Orange County Weekly, by the way. We're going to put a link at our website, here-now.org. You can check it out for yourself. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. Robin Young, It's Here and Now. They aren't Brazilian, there's just one girl, and you can imagine what comes up when you Google their name, but though they've only released a couple of albums, the band, the Brazilian Girls, has made itself a must-listen-to on the New York club scene and beyond. With a sound that mixes insistent rhythm with a multitude of languages and musical styles, they've just released a CD, their second, and you're listening to the title track, Talk to La Bomb. And we're joined from the Argo Network studios by two members of the Brazilian Girls, lead singer and the only girl, Sabina Shuba. Sabina, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
We're also joined by Didi Gutman, who plays keyboard and sampler. Hi, Didi.
Hi, how are you?
So I know you're probably so tired of this question, but we have to ask it. Sabina, why do you call yourselves the Brazilian Girls?
Because everybody loves Brazilian girls.
You know, you don't have to ask.
You're absolutely right. But Sabina, you are Italian?
I'm Italo-German.
You could have called yourselves the Italian-German girls. But
that would have been too obvious.
Right. And that seems to be the take on the band. You don't want to be too obvious.
Very much so, yeah.
Tell me more about that.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of things that aren't the straightforward route that we took, for example. Musically, the direction-wise, it's not reggae, it's not dance, it's not techno, it's not pure electronica, so we're very open to whatever babies we give birth to. Yeah, I guess also in terms of our image, we're just trying not to be too... It's not even we're trying not to be obvious, it's just, I guess, we just go with our instincts and that's what they dictate.
And it's global. Didi, we were talking and you told me you're Polish, Russian, born in Argentina?
Yes, that's right. And we all live in New York, and we're all part of a very international community, and it's reflected in our music, too.
Yeah, it is in the languages. Sabina, how many do you speak? Because they show up in the songs.
Six, for now.
For now. Well, let's hear a little of that mix of languages. This is the first track from your CD, Talk to La Bomb. Mm-hmm. It's called Hike, and that word, you know six languages, but you still made this word up.
The pronunciation is actually... Hike.
It's got like a silent N in the
Wow.
It sounds
it's almost like how do you call it in a meditation when you use these sounds?
Like mantras.
It's like a mantra.
It's like a
mantra with an instant release, and that's kind of what it means.
A mantra with an instant release. Let's listen. Sounds like something a little scandalous, maybe?
Whatever gets you through the night.
Enrique, apparently. Talk about how you came to be. We read you were one of the resident bands at a Lower East Side club, Nublu. New York Times Magazine featured you as some of the artists helping to keep downtown New York alive. What is it about the city, Didi? You said it's an international community, but what else is it about that city that keeps you alive?
I think the music, really, for me. And, the people, too. I love my circle of friends.
Well, one of them, apparently, is Rick Ocasek. We here in Boston, of course, know him fondly as the lead singer, songwriter, and rhythm guitarist of the Boston-based band The Cars. He was a guest producer on one cut on the album. Let's listen to a little of that first. It's the song Last Call.
Last Call. Bar hopping. J'ai grand appétit. city. We've gotten so far. The boys say, oh, we're not stopping.
Sabina, working with Rico Kasich, what did that bring to you?
He's a very interesting and a very amiable and very lovable guy. At the same time, he's obviously, you know, he's got a major rock star thing going on, which is, it's inspiring. You know, I always find it inspiring to see someone who's had a career and who still is a human being and not a freak, you know, and doesn't wear tons of makeup or something.
Speaking of, you know, sort of getting us to the image of a band, yours has one. For instance, Sabina, you very rarely are seen with your eyes. Although, when I opened the liner notes to the new CD, way back buried, like the third photo in, we can see your face, which is...
Yeah, but you're just half sideways. You can't
just
really
sideways. That's right. Why is that? Usually there's sunglasses or a bar across your eyes. Why?
Just so I don't intimidate women with my immaculate beauty.
Okay, that's A. And B would be...
B would be, like you said earlier, you know, it's about mystery and about not stating the obvious and not doing the obvious and having them use their imagination, you know.
You look at the rest of the band, well, there's the mysterious Sabina. Then there's a fellow with a mohawk. Is that you, Dee Dee, by the way?
No, that's Aaron.
That's Aaron.
The drummer.
Are you the guy with the Rastafarian hair?
Yes. Polish, Russian, Argentinian, Rastafarian situation.
A cynic would say, gee, there's something focus grouped here. You know, let's get an art look that, you know, targets something. And you would say what?
La bohème, la bohème. I think that's what we're targeting. I think we're targeting the bohemian in all of us.
Never met a German, never even seen one. I read it on the newsstand that day that the tanks were rolling. Next thing I remember is that I'm walking in the army. Following instructions, it isn't very charming. Oh no.
Sabina, I want to ask you quickly about I Never Met a German. You are singing in the voice of what? A soldier turned general?
Can I say this? I'm turning about a pacifist turned Nazi.
Yeah, pretty much. And a Nazi who loves seeing the tanks roll by.
Well, it's about power and about the denial and about the corruptive effects of power on anyone's mind. It's sort of about, obviously, you know, Germans being a target for prejudices regarding fascism and Nazism, and it's important to understand that there is no nation that has been more exemplary than another, you know. I mean, it's just human nature to abuse power.
You said you had a German, part German background. Is this...
I've lived in Germany for many years.
Is this a defending...
No, I don't feel like I need to defend Germans. It's kind of a humorous approach, looking at the present political situation and looking at extreme right politics being pushed through under the how do you say, under the cover of like of freedom, you know. Fascism is fascism, however it's presented, you know. And I think we're seeing a lot of fascism right now in the world.
That's Sabina Shuba, along with Dee Dee Gutman. They are members of the band The Brazilian Girls. Their new CD is Talk to La Bomb. They're touring the U.S. and Canada this fall. For more information, including their visit here in Boston, go to our website, here-now.org. Thank you both.
Thank you so much, honey.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
He is always there, la sentinelle, it's hiver. Le matin, ça bouge à Chinatown. Les marchés...
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.